Hello, Blogging Heads Nation. It's the Back to School National Security Edition with Heather Hurlburt at the National Security Network and
Eli Lake of the Washington Times and the New Republic.
That New Republic attribution's new, Eli. What's up with that?
I mean, check the masthead. I'm a contributing editor.
Check the masthead. Ooh, my bad.
Sorry.
Snap.
All right. No, but my primarily Washington Times.
An early solo home run for Eli.
Yes.
Today what we thought we'd do is run our eyes across the globe and note that there's just kind of an insane concatenation of foreign policy challenges coming to a head this fall that, in a funny way, although you may not have noticed that we had a little bit of an international honeymoon over the last 8-9 months, it's now officially over. We have, in between now and the next time anybody gets a significant holiday, we have the debate over more troops for Afghanistan, the kerfuffle around the fraudulence of the Afghanistan elections, the end of September deadline, quote unquote, about for the Iranians to respond to the offer of negotiations on their weapons program, the expectation that shortly there's going to be an announcement related to the startup of final status talks in the Middle East, pressure to pass an energy bill and then go to Copenhagen in December, the need for the administration to come forward with its concrete plan on closing Guantanamo, and then how Congress is going to react to that. What have I left out, Eli?
I think that's pretty good. I mean, Arab-Israel.
Yeah. So the interesting to me kind of thread that ties all these things together, well, there's a couple. One is that they're all complex and defy sort of easy ideological categorization, or at least should defy easy ideological categorization. Second, they're all kind of hangover problems where we start sort of way down in a hole with fewer options than we ought to have. And third, they all require, or at least my preferred solutions to them, require at least a tweak, if not a significant change, to the kind of conventional wisdom about how the U.S. does things. And so I think sort of going on below the radar, because healthcare is taking up all the available oxygen and then some, but going on below the radar, you have two really interesting sets of debates, and one is just a partisan one where there is just a vociferous sort of partisan back and forth going on over national security issues, and sort of struggling for advantage that may or may not become more evident once healthcare dies down. But second, you also have a debate that doesn't line up with partisanship, but that lines up between sort of what you would call a more traditional realist school, and then another school that I'm not even sure what to call it, that's kind of neocons on both sides of the aisle, so I'm not sure neocons is really the right word for it. And the administration comes down in different places on this debate, depending what the issue is, which I should say is typical of people who find themselves in office, that they end up trying to take the best from both the realist and what we used to call the liberal internationalist school, but I'm not sure that's really quite the right word for a group that I think includes or is in some cases led by the neocons. So there's these kind of odd shifting battle lines on these issues and people who are partners on one issue and fierce opponents on another one. So it's a very complex scenario for each of these issues, which are complex in their own right, sort of totally aside from the domestic political context, which I think is all going to make for a really crazy fall.
Yes. Well, do you want to get specific? I mean,
why don't we start with Iran, because that's your favorite.
Yes.
Iran is fascinating to me because you have the administration taking something that sort of out of laziness I'm tempted to refer to as a realist position, but of course it's much more complicated than that. But basically saying, you know, yes, Ahmadinejad is a bad man, but that's not the key point. The key point is that Iran has certain sort of strategic and regional strengths that mean we're going to have to deal with them, that we're not going to be able to make them go away. And so then the question is, what's the best? How do you go about seeing what the best deal you can get from them is? And then second, saying, okay, well, it's fun to be unilateral and come up with unilateral sanctions and unilateral postures and talk about unilateral military strikes, but in fact, the only thing effective you can do against Iran is multilateral, which I think this sort of shows you how quickly you get back out of the traditional sort of realist worldview, where you say, on the one hand, we have to talk to them. On the other hand, the only thing to back up talking to them is actually building a coalition that looks that looks very liberal internationalist. And so you have this crazy alphabet soup of meetings going on right now, from the P5 plus Germany meeting in Germany to plot strategy vis-a-vis Iran. You have the International Atomic Energy Agency meetings. Then you have a string of meetings both in New York at the UN and in Pittsburgh at the G20. And if your head is already spinning, so is mine. With the result that the theory is, anyway, that in a few weeks you have either Iran says, yes, we'll talk to you about our nuclear program, or you have a new set of sanctions coming out of the UN Security Council. And that's kind of the very pared down set of options. And then there's, in addition, the crazy way that the Israeli government has succeeded in tying up Iran and its particular nuclear issues with Israel's issues with Iran, and then through that with Israel's issues with the peace process. So you have the Israelis trying to create this sort of complex three-way bargain, which there's
no,
a lot.
I don't think the Israelis are trying to do that.
Okay, what do you think the Israelis are
well,
trying to do?
Well, I think the Israelis would like to see no linkage. I mean, that's been their position for some time between, you know, increasing Western pressure. I don't think they have much. I mean, we'll see. I mean, Netanyahu just had a secret meeting with Medvedev in Moscow. We'll see what comes of that, but, you know, I'm doubtful.
Okay, we got to back up there, because there was also this report, this fascinating Muslim Brotherhood document that was just, quote, leaked, unquote, by somebody somewhere, about the Muslim Brothers saying, you know, we should work more with Russia to try to get Russia to be an opponent to our enemies in the West. And so that's an interesting footnote on sort of why one has to worry about Russia so much, and that the sort of the fantasy place that Russia plays in a lot of people's thinking as a counterweight to the U.S.,
well,
especially while oil prices are high.
Yes, in some ways that's like the Elks Club leaking a document saying, you know, we should think about a new China foreign policy. Anyway, no, I'm just kidding. This is because the Muslim Brotherhood is really a civic organization, and it's true that they have a tremendous amount of influence in Egypt, and they have, I think, you know, very ambitious goals in terms of converting lots of people to Islam. And they have a view of what Islam should be and Islamic republics. And they're an important political player, but they don't really get to have a foreign policy yet. At least I don't think so. But that's interesting. But let's.
So
I want to get back to
this
question of linkage, because I think that there's been a bit of a misperception. I think the Israelis want to have. I mean, I think the reason Netanyahu, in his visit to Washington in the spring, at least at first said he was happy, was because he felt that there was a commitment from Obama to have a deadline to the offer of talks, and that there wasn't a linkage between the Iran problem, and that also it's important for Israel, I think, to see the Iran issue, to have the West see the Iran issue, and particularly the United States see the Iran issue as a security threat to everyone and not as a favor to the Jewish state. Then there's a separate question of settlements, and we can talk about that, but that is something that is going to be difficult for a center-right government in Israel, but also the Israeli population has largely, they're not one, they're certainly, I mean, there's no longer an Israeli right that wants to keep all of the land that Israel won in the Six-Day War, nor is there, I think, an Israeli constituency that really has the faith in the kind of peace process and land for peace formula of a Yossi Beilin or what we would associate with the Meretz parties in Israel. And that has changed the Israeli dynamic and the Israeli polity to a point where I think that to a degree, Obama's kind of publicly, and Obama officials publicly challenging the Israelis over settlement construction, by the way, within blocks that the Israelis believe that a final status agreement they would keep as part of the Jewish state.
Yeah, that's exactly the issue, and you've been Eli, very, very honest to say that, because you're exactly right that, number one, the dynamic in Israel has changed tremendously in ways that I think maybe Americans who don't focus on it regularly don't appreciate just how far public sentiment in Israel has moved from where it was the last time there was a serious focus on the peace process. But that indeed there's an acceptance that big swaths of land will eventually go back, but there's an increased focus on keeping other chunks of land, some of which everybody thinks Israel will keep and some of which not everybody thinks Israel will or should keep, and that's the problem. That's the real debate over settlements now, not so much that the Israelis are sort of trying to take over just huge swaths of new area, but that there are certain very targeted areas which are hotly contested, and some of which are essential to having, you know, a Palestinian state that's in any way viable.
Contiguous.
Yes, that the Israelis are intent on keeping, and that's where the height of the construction is occurring.
Well, I mean, I've done a little bit of reporting on this over the summer, but what's interesting is I think that the Bush administration got a Sharon government not just to get out of Gaza to a degree. Well, Sharon wanted to do that unilaterally. They came, but also, you know, a lot of the subsidization of settlement activity, the land confiscation, and certainly sort of new settlements, and the beginnings of enforcement of renegade settlement activities, all of this was a sea change that was ostensibly under Olmert after Sharon, a kind of center-right government. And then you have Netanyahu, who kind of reinvents himself as the critic of disengagement, but has not even talked about trying to get back into Gaza. And I think, you know, kind of inherits what is a lot of Israeli position, which is that they don't want to unilaterally leave the West Bank at this point because they feel that they'll get a rocket war in Tel Aviv. So it's a very difficult situation for them. And I just, all I would say is that, you know, this, I wonder if Obama is getting much bang for the buck, because when Clinton would chastise Netanyahu the first time around, Heather, the Israeli public loved Bill Clinton. They believed that he was he really did care about Israeli security. And at least if you were to believe the opinion polls, a lot of the Israeli public does not believe that Obama has Israel's
Obama
national
security. Obama has not made that sale yet. It's one
so
of
he
the,
should send yeah. Clinton as his man in Jerusalem, like Tony Blair and Clinton. Could you get better than that? Right.
No, I think then there's an interesting corollary to that, Eli. I agree with your diagnosis of where the Israeli public is, which is that in some ways Obama has to push or appear to be pushing the Netanyahu government on settlements both for the Arabs and for the Europeans. But at the same time, everybody knows that. So it's this crazy dance where they need to do it, but the Arabs also know, you know, the Arabs know the same things that you and I and Obama knows. So they're having trouble getting the traction they need from the Arab side either. And the thing that has dropped sort of completely out of reporting, and I would like to hope it's because positive things are happening behind the scenes, but I fear that might be naive of me, is progress toward there actually being a unity Palestinian government that could be a serious participant in negotiations. Because, you know, I understand why you want to create sort of the motion machine by having, as is rumored to be the goal, having Netanyahu and Abbas and Obama stand up together at the UN and announce the start of talks. But if Abbas doesn't represent anything, then you can't get anywhere from that side. I mean, as we've seen painfully in the past, and I don't have a sense that there's been progress on that, but as I say, I'm hoping that I'm mistaken.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering about a unity government on the Palestinian side, given the fact that we've recently seen pretty senior Fatah representatives say that they didn't mean it when they said that they believed that Israel had a right to exist. And then the unity partner, of course, would be Hamas. Is there a sign, is there a signal anywhere besides, you know, Jimmy Carter's imagination that Hamas is moderated? I mean, I'm just curious because they don't seem to have moderated. And if there was a unity government that Israel would meet with, they would have to accept the basics of what, I mean, I think that the reasonable condition of past agreements that the Palestinian Authority signed with Israel, which so far the Hamas side has not been willing to do. So could you have a unity government that would bring in Hamas? And if that's what you're talking about, what we're really talking about is, can you get Hamas to become a partner for peace? And that, I think, is a far tougher question than some folks in town, like Mally and Daniel Levy and others, have said. I mean, they said, well, you know, you just have to meet with them and try something new. But I don't see it. I mean, is there evidence that they're going to give up their irredentism?
Well,
they're going to pull an Ariel Sharon.
Eli, there are two sort of different points there. And one is not to treat Hamas as a monolith, or not to create the conditions that let Hamas get more monolithic and make it harder for moderates to emerge. And of course, if you treat them as, the more you treat them as a monolith, the more they'll be a monolith. And second, I think there are a lot of options and possibilities in between the situation that we have now and some sort of halcyon future where, you know, Netanyahu can sit down with, what's his name, Khaled Mashal, and, you know, sort of chat to each other and agree on, you know, say that they accept Oslo and everything since Oslo or whatever it is. That I think what you're really looking at is a situation where Abbas would have a fighting chance to get an agreement and take it back and sell it. That's really the best you could hope for. And I think, you know, people on both your side and my side shouldn't over fetishize what having Hamas in a government would mean. It would neither be as good as, say, maybe Jimmy Carter thinks it would be, or as bad as, say, Elliot Abrams thinks it would be. You know, you don't actually necessarily want to, certainly not in their current form with the ideology they've got. I'm not sure you want to put them at the table, but there does have to be a way, there does have to be a route for somebody to sell an agreement to that chunk of the population on the grounds that it could produce a status quo that's better than the current status quo. Which is, after all, what Hamas has done so well, by the way, you know, lest we forget, both in terms of practical services on the ground and in terms of a vision. It's actually sort of saying something to regular Palestinians about how things could be better, which, you know, Fatah has pretty dismally failed to do, unfortunately.
Well, as readers of Richard Haass's work on peace processes will tell you, that these things require both sides to become exhausted and for the irredentists essentially to split. So what you need is a real IRA. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you need for a real, maybe like you need a Hamas, you need Hamas to split. Yep. I'm with you on the fact that they can't be monolithic, but I think that we need to get to that point, and to put the cart before the horse is to ask Israel to do what we wouldn't ask of any, you know, ally or for that matter, sovereign nation. You can't have a nation negotiate with people who every day teach their children to that one day they will annihilate the partner.
But Eli, I just said a minute ago that this isn't about asking the Israelis to sit down and negotiate with Hamas. And the other point is the way that you get a party to split, I mean, the way that you got the split in Ireland, of course, was that there were actually some things that made some IRA members think, hey, there might be a better way to achieve some of these goals, that there have to be carrots.
There's also a famous mole that that the Brits had on the IRA side. There's a famous spy that they had that came out in the Atlantic a few years ago.
Right, but one spy doesn't create the societal
change.
A really
good, well-placed spy.
No, one spy. I mean, that's sort of the great man theory of history versus the
great
societal
spy
change
theory of history.
No. All right, so be it noted that Eli adheres to the great spy theory of history and Heather does not.
Let's get to Iran. You want to talk about Iran? Because you
absolutely.
Seem you at this point it's like comedy to me, Heather. I mean, they just nominated, who's their defense minister? He's wanted by the ICC. There's a red nose on him.
Right.
Yeah, they have show trials right now about from very good reformers, people that you know, a year ago you would hope, you know, you would say, you know, those are the people that after an election that we could negotiate with, whether they be Karoubi's people or Khatami's people. And what's left is what is left in Iran? I mean, it's a hardcore revolutionary bunch of terrorists. That's who we've got. And literally, in some cases, wanted by Interpol for terrorism. So it's not like I'm saying terrorists to be dramatic. I'm saying literally wanted criminals, a Manson-esque regime. What are you going to do?
So, I mean, Eli, I think, first of all, the thing, you know, they're a crappy regime. They're full of people who have done bad things. The difference between you and me is not over whether, you know, there are angels in the regime or, you know, whether it's interesting to debate whether they are or aren't terrorists. The question is, what are you going to do about it? And, you know, so... who is going to arrest them and how is that going to meet any sort of test of efficiency and practicality?
All right.
Send the 81st Airborne to arrest them?
No, I'm basically joking, but Obama has enough credibility as a kind of squishy sort of, you know, diplomacy first president. I'm joking here, audience. He could set up a huge thing and said, I want Fahidi and I want all these other guys who are wanted by Interpol. and then instead of showing up to negotiate with them, arrest them. No, kidding. That's a little bit of a joke. I realize that you can't actually do that, but I don't know. What I'm saying is, I don't even know if you could get a deal with these with the rump that is left of the Revolutionary Guard state in Iran, given their track record of not adhering to international agreements that they've signed, given our experience with North Korea saying they're going to do one thing and then doing something else, and our worries regard to the sort of, you know, could the NPT survive one more North Korea type incident, you know, what do you even expect to get in terms of the negotiations? I'm not saying we invade Iran, but I'm just wondering, like, at this point, and then I think there is a cost that you pay at this point for negotiating with this regime in the middle of the show trials. The message that you send to all these brave Iranians who continue to say, enough, we don't want the dictatorship, we don't want to go totally towards tyranny, is that the U.S. just doesn't care. And these things can matter, you know, to an opposition movement. It's not entirely true that we can do nothing on that. So I'm wondering, like, what do you get out of it at this point?
Okay, so first of all, let's back up and remind ourselves that the North Korean breakouts have come in periods when they weren't negotiating with the U.S. as opposed to periods when they were. So let's sort of remember that first. Second, unfortunately, I think, you know, we would agree that Iran's a much tougher nut than North Korea and a much more serious problem. So even though I actually think the North Korean example points my way, I'm not sure it's really very, very useful. Because if Iran were, you know, as easily contained as North Korea, you and I would be talking about something else. So then the question is, okay, what do? You can't overthrow the government. You have fairly limited tools to influence what goes on inside. You have exterior problems regardless of what government there is in Iran, and you would continue to have those problems regardless of what government there was in Iran because, you know, let's just remind ourselves, yes, the reformers would produce a situation that was much better for Iran's people, but there's really no indication that they would be less interested in pursuing nuclear power.
Disagree. Keep going.
Okay.
Disagree.
So you have, you know, we have a problem with Iran, which is that Iran sees itself as a regional power with interests that clash with our interests in the region, regardless of what their government is. And that's the situation that you have to manage, regardless of who the government is. So, what do you do? So, of course, we're not negotiating with Iran right now. We're not negotiating with them while they're having their show trials. And a number of Iran experts have actually said that it's incredibly useful to put the regime under additional pressure by saying, hey, you guys can come negotiate with us about your weapons program if you'd like, and this is what's on offer. And that you're actually seeing in the further turmoil inside the government in the kind of announcement one day that that they will and the next day that they won't, you know, it's a good old Leninist strategy of accentuate the contradictions. The other thing that this gambit does is move us from the situation we were in, you know, a year, 18 months, 2 years ago, where the U.S. would say there need to be more sanctions, and the Europeans would say, yeah, you guys are a bunch of jerks, we're not interested in more sanctions, not to mention the Russians and the Chinese, who, of course, you have to have for really effective global sanctions.
Get a dissent on that one, too.
To a situation where now, because of the combination of what the Iranians did to their own citizens, which helped a lot with the Europeans, and the administration showing that it was actually willing to try negotiating and that it didn't have an ideological objection to negotiating, you now have a situation where the French, the Germans, even I believe the Russians have gone on record with saying, you know, we're ready to look. If the Iranians don't come back with a favorable response in September, we're ready to put more sanctions in place. So you know, you're you know, if they want to negotiate, then you've got to figure out how to do that in a way that doesn't strengthen the regime internally. You're right, but frankly, it's not looking as if the Iranians are going to be able to call to answer the challenge on that. And then you're in a much stronger position to actually create a meaningful international response.
Okay, well, let's go backwards first. I agree with your last point, your Leninist point, which is that if you sort of just say, all right, well, we're not saying we're not going to negotiate, then it does deprive the Basiji Revolutionary Guard, secret police, of a propaganda point, though I don't know how important that is, given the fact that I think most Iranians at this point know what they're up against and know who they're dealing with.
Well, Eli, if that's true, if most Iranians know what they're up against and what they're dealing with, then your whole argument that we can't negotiate with the government because of the signal it sends to the people is wrong.
No, disagree. I think that if you negotiate with the government, I mean, I'm saying I don't doubt that, like, that the regime at this point is despised, that people think that it was a stolen election. The reason is because the question that they have is, will a country that has traditionally stood for rule of law, liberalism, and all these values that in some ways we're looking to open up our society, will they, see kind of fellow struggling Democrats, and do they care? Or are they basically interested in locking in an agreement with our tormentors? And that's a separate level of question about whether or not negotiating with the regime will make the regime more popular. Because I agree with the Iranian people. But I want to get back to the point about Europe, which is that Sarkozy has been strong on sanctions because he's Sarkozy, I don't think that that's exactly right, that Europeans have been more willing. I think that you still have the Russians and the Chinese who are uninterested in any serious sanctions, and I still think that you have, if you talk to the Germans, they would say that we've supported a lot of these sanctions. They have a separate problem with their industries, and similar, like, to the Italians. So I think that you've seen a sea change in Europe, only that's not really because of Obama. I think that the Europeans have been on board. I think that you're right that maybe European publics have gotten behind pressuring the Iranian regime, in part because of what they saw in June and what they still see in terms of these show trials. So that's a separate question, but I think that the governments have been largely supportive in Europe of more pressure. And also, I would point out that it was Burns who went last summer to offer the freeze for freeze, and then was told by, I think, Saeed Jalili, no, or there was no response, as often is with the Iranians. So the Bush administration, in its final months, reversed course on its strategy of not negotiating until they stopped uranium enrichment. There was the beginning of that, and the Iranians said no. And, you know, Obama has certainly been more active in saying that he's open for talks, and the response has been what we've seen. And I think that you can't, I don't think that, you know, this internal stuff, you can't separate it. I think the Iranians know how difficult it makes Obama's job to negotiate from his political perspective when they're out shooting young women in the streets. Don't you agree? I'm not saying that the two things are totally connected, but it's like you can't just put that in a box. They know what they did. They know what they did with that election. They're aware that that has an implication as well. So I just think that the other big point here is that sometimes you just take no for an answer, right?
So Eli, I guess that my question to you, the point about the Bush administration is interesting because they were driven to changing their approach in the waning year because nothing else had worked. And so I think, you know, really where we are at the moment is, except for the people who take the let's bomb them now approach, there are people who sort of say, okay, the Obama administration is doing the smartest thing it can. And there are people who are sort of very, you know, find that really unappealing and complain about it every step of the way, but ultimately come around to the same set of policies because they're just really, and then this again, it's typical of a lot of the issues that we're looking at. There really just aren't a lot of other options.
Sure there are. They first of all, the Obama administration, if they don't have one already, and I don't know that they don't have one.
What are the other than multilateral sanctions, the prospect of engagement and trying to build better multilateral sanctions, what are the other policy options?
Well, first of all, there is clearly an opposition movement in Iran right now. We know that they had a preferred candidate. We know the people around him. If the Obama administration does not have a channel to that camp, albeit it would be very secret, and I can understand why they wouldn't announce that. So I'm not saying they don't have it, okay?
That doesn't count as hypotheticals. Don't count, and that's not an alternative policy option.
Sure, it is. But there is a policy. There's okay. First of all, I want to remind you of the brilliance of Madeleine Albright dealing with Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia. Her policy option after bombing them for Kosovo, to stop the cleansing of Kosovo, was one of Velvet Revolution. Now, this is a weird, touchy subject, because in Iran, they are trying people who are innocent, like this guy I just wrote about, Kian Tajbagash. I forget how to pronounce his name. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm not a Persian speaker. Okay? But he's being tried for trying to foment a Velvet Revolution. So I should say that I know of no... But I'm saying that there was, in fact, a kind of policy in 1999 and 2000 in the State Department regarding mm-hmm. working with an opposition in Serbia. We've talked about this before. I've written about this before. There, you kind of want a policy like that. You just don't want to announce it, I guess. You want to sort of do it and not talk about it. So my hope is that
you also want, by the way, a policy that's culturally and regionally appropriate, whatever you're doing with the opposition in Iran, it probably doesn't and shouldn't look like what you were doing with the opposition in Serbia,
where you had
all kinds of regional and continental and European ways of doing that work, you know, in addition to what Jim, the little operation that Jim O'Brien was running out of the State Department at that period. And, you know, there's a lot of those tools that, frankly, we don't have in the Iranian case, and then this is a much bigger problem than sort of Obama versus Bush or whatever, that both because of where Iran is versus where Serbia is, where Serbia fit in the power structure versus where Iran fits in the power structure, and our own pretty dismal failure to have in our State Department or intelligence hierarchies the kind of depth of language and cultural skills we need. You know, I'm not sure that we would be able, either for internal or external reasons, to have anything like what was done against Milosevic.
Can I sketch out a scenario? I have no knowledge. Samantha Power, okay, who knows a whole lot about these things. He's friends with Azar Nafisi, who knows a lot of these people, right? I bet they could come up with something. I bet they could come up with, like, who you talk to, what they want, and it could very well be that Mousavi's people... I mean, I have talked to the filmmaker in Paris, mm-hmm. who is kind of a spokesman for now, an official spokesman for Mousavi, a couple times, and they say they don't want any legitimization of the coup d'etat government. So that's one thing that they say publicly, but I bet... Behind the scenes, they might say, you know what, we want you to negotiate, but we want to make sure that you press for the release of the following real political prisoners. Mm-hmm. I mean, that kind of... I'm just saying having the channel can open up possibilities for the policy. And as for sanctions, I would hate for the sanctions to be... And here I'm going to go argue against type, I guess. I would hate for sanctions to be... to already add to the burdens of Iranian citizens.
Yeah.
You should have sanctions that focus on... the regime leadership. And in this respect, I mean, I was joking before, it wouldn't be such a bad idea to give the Iranian regime the message that there are senior people in your government who are wanted by, you know, Interpol, and there are also investigations that we could start up in places like, I don't know, Austria regarding Ahmadinejad and the murder of a Kurdish leader named Gassemblou. Mm-hmm. There are things that, I mean, the people running the government right now really are the really, I'm not, this is not rhetoric. They're terrorists. There is a kind of mechanism in that respect as well to sanction the individual leadership, to try to go after money that they need that's, you know, part of every kind of illicit, you know, trafficking of all kinds of sorts in the region. There are things that you can do from kind of like an international law enforcement perspective that's being done very quietly that can,
so, Eli,
can pressure
the thing,
them.
The thing I think to keep in mind about all of this is I think the same argument you used on me, I can use back on you, which is the Revolutionary Guard folks who are increasingly, you know, seeming to wield control in Iran, none of this stuff is going to work on them. And that's a very...
Well, take their money and maybe arrest them every now and again. That's good.
But what taking their money is going to do, and it's just important that we understand this, taking their money is not going to make them decide to lose fair and square in an election next time. Taking their money is going to do is going to weaken them so that eventually internal forces in Iran can push them out. But it's going to be it's going to be long. It's going to be ultimately internal. And judging by what we've seen so far, it's not going to be very nice when it happens. So, when we talk about this, it's not as if, you know, Sam Power and somebody in Iran together can cook up a neat little scheme that will sort of magically engineer a palace coup one day. This is going to be an ugly, difficult, bloody process. It appears. I mean, I don't want to pose as an Iran expert, which I'm not.
But don't you? Would you not also agree that there are many smart people who say when you're faced with a violent regime like Iran that is willing to torture and do all kinds of terrible things and show trial and hang people in public, and it's awful, okay, that you don't that's not necessarily true that the only way to get rid of such a regime is to have a violent counter-reaction from an opposition, but that maybe the best way, at least Milosevic was pretty violent, as we would agree, right, is that mm-hmm. you can use non-violent people power organizing. And I've always thought since the beginning of the Iran political crisis in June that the president is a former community organizer. And by the way, I say this as a good thing, okay? And he knows what community organizing looks like. And if you looked at Iran, that most of what the opposition was doing was community organizing through kind of social media and community organizing just the old-fashioned way. They were going out and they were protesting. And now there are like these things that they're doing on the web where they – it used to be – I mean, there's a wonderful article by Laura Secor about 3 weeks ago, and I really hadn't – but she pointed this out, which was really smart, that there were these videos of people who had been sort of forced to make the confessions on television and so forth. And they were that used to be a sign of sort of like, okay, well, I guess the government was right. But now it's a sign of look how the government has tortured this person, and that they're mocking them. So I mean, I see this stuff and I say to myself, they largely seem to be committed to kind of a nonviolent civil opposition, and that's certainly been what Khatami, that's certainly the Karoubi, and that's what these other folks have been saying.
So, Eli, just a concluding thought on this, because this takes us back to the systemic problem with American foreign policy, which is that the kind of community organizing nonviolent change model you're talking about is immensely frustrating both from the inside and the outside, and it's why being a community organizer is so damn hard. Because if you remember, in 99 and 2000, people were hugely critical of that Milosevic effort.
Yes.
And why isn't it working? And this is ridiculous. And it's a waste of money.
Right.
And, eventually it worked on a timetable that was largely determined by folks inside Yugoslavia, and that, frankly, we had not as much influence over as we might like to think. And it didn't, it hasn't all turned out maybe as wonderfully as some people thought it would. So American foreign the domestic levers of American foreign policy are so ill-equipped to deal with things that are done behind the scenes, that are quiet, that are partial, that take a long time, and that don't have grand, eloquent gestures that we can go out and point to somebody up in the balcony.
Totally agree with you.
Totally agree with you. The nonviolent community organizer, sort of the best thing we can do is figure out how to provide support from the outside. At the same time as we have to sort of take care of our regional and geopolitical interests in the meantime, is the right way to go. But the solutions there are really dissatisfying, especially to an American foreign policy establishment that wants action, and that on so many of these issues, I think this is the problem that we're up against. That the old metaphor about three-dimensional chess versus checkers, that the situation demands chess, yet what the establishment wants to see is an action movie.
Well, I want to just comment on just two things I kind of agree with you on here, which is one is that you're right, the foreign policy apparatus is not equipped to support, and it should only be support, it should not be mastermind, indigenous velvet revolution, nonviolent civil resistance movements. And therefore, it should really be like, hopefully we can have some sort of, non-governmental organization network that doesn't have to go through the budgeting
process. We do. It's called George Soros.
Well, Soros is one. And there's a couple other people. Right. Well, it would be nice if Soros would have the Open Society Institute do something about Iran. That would be very good. And maybe take some of the money.
Well, is it you who's written, Eli, about how the interesting thing is the Iranians are convinced that everything that happens there is the result of George Soros?
You could argue
that he's helpfully spreading paranoia among the Iranian regime without spending dime.
yes, they think Soros is behind everything. I mean,
actually, we shouldn't even. I mean, I sort of want to take this back because of my fear that the clip will be seen somewhere and used out of context. Because the things that are being done to people because of George Soros and the way, frankly, that Soros's efforts are used, you know, to justify anti-Semitism and all kinds of outrageous prejudices is kind of not very funny. And I should also, in the interest of truth and advertising, say that my organization gets some money from Open Society.
Okay. Well, I don't get any money from George Soros. Okay.
But you had one more thing to say before we wrap up.
Well, I mean, just on this, on the point about, like, sort of wanting to see action, I would just hope that the idea would be do no harm, which is why the only thing that I really care about, even though I agree with you that this alone is not a policy, is that I would hope that there was a channel that was reliable to the Iranian opposition, right? And that there was a way for Obama to sort of check diplomatic overtures and so forth in such a way that it was not used to demoralize what is, I think, you know, a hopeful in the face of incredible cruelty movement. Okay. That's all I'm saying. Right. Is that do no harm, which is that I don't think you're going to get a deal with the Iranians. I don't think the Iranians want a deal. And I think the only reason they would agree to sit down and talk is to because they use it as a way to tell their own population, rest of population, see the United States doesn't care about you. So if there was a way to mitigate that, and, you know, I don't know, you know, then they should try to mitigate it. That's the only thing I would say.
On that note of agreement, Eli, see you next time.
Is that it? All right, good stuff. Thank you.
Bye.